Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinary press conference that Donald Trump convened in Trump Tower to answer questions about his promise to deliver millions of dollars to charities for veterans. Noah Bierman, who covers national politics for the Los Angeles Times, joins us to discuss his article at the LA Times, Slamming the Media, Trump Answers Criticism Over His Contributions to Veterans Charities, and the unprecedented relationship that Trump has with the press, in as much as he has gotten some $2 billion worth of free promotion from the press while biting the hand that feeds him by insulting and castigating journalists for asking questions that Trump does not want to answer. We will assess who won the exchange as the media-savvy TV reality star threw red meat to his followers, feigning victimhood at the hands of the so-called liberal media, who Trump complained should be congratulating him for his good deeds, rather than following up on whether he has been good to his word. Then we will look into the other object of Trump's scorn at today's testy press conference, and that is the neoconservative kingmaker Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, who Trump called a loser whose magazine is failing. I don't think it even survives. Jacob Halbrun, the editor of The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, joins us to discuss Trump's outburst, which is clearly in retaliation for Kristol's efforts to recruit a third-party candidate to run against Trump as a true conservative, and who the mystery candidate might be that Bill Kristol has promised in his tweet that, quote, will be an independent candidate, an impressive one, with a strong team and a real chance. Then finally, we'll speak with Joe Garofoli, the San Francisco Chronicle senior political writer, who was the pool reporter covering Bernie Sanders' rally in Oakland at which animal rights activists stormed the stage. Then, along with actor Danny Glover, the candidate attended the Western Conference NBA final game, which the home team, the Golden State Warriors, won. We will discuss Bernie Sanders' remark that the Warriors, quote, turned it around, and that's what our campaign is going to do. And joining us now is Noah Bierman, who covers national politics for the Los Angeles Times from the Mid-Atlantic region out of Washington, D.C. Before joining the newspaper in 2015, he worked for the Boston Globe and then prior to that, the Miami Herald. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Slamming the Media, Trump Answers Criticism Over His Contributions to Veterans Charities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Noah Bierman.
Thanks for having me.
And what did you make of this extraordinary press conference today at Trump Tower, where Trump was particularly testy? He accused reporters of being sleazy and really went after them. But in general, he's been on the defensive about this whole idea of him giving money to the vets instead of going to a Fox News presidential primary debate. And I guess he's been smoked out by particularly by the Washington Post reporter David Fahrenthold about what happened to this money, and he finally had to come clean, and he didn't seem like a happy camper.
No, it was a pretty combative press conference. As you said, you know, he used the word sleazy. It wasn't just reporters; it was other people too. I mean, he talked about some Republican establishment figures and some conservatives, people like Bill Kristol, who's trying to create a third party movement against Trump. He called him a loser and said his magazine was failing. A CNN reporter, he said sarcastically to him in the middle of a question about whether he could take the scrutiny, I've seen you on TV, you're quite a beauty. And there was another question during the press conference where he was asked, you know, is this what a Trump presidential briefing would look like? And he said, yes, it is. So it's also a bit of a preview, you know, if he is president, that this will be a style, obviously, we haven't seen before, and one that's worked well in the primaries for Donald Trump, because he has rallied a lot of his supporters who are, you know, at the least skeptical of mainstream media and institutions like the Republican Party, and in many cases contemptuous of them. So it has worked well. But like everything in the primary, we don't know how it's going to look in the general election. It'll be a different question, possibly.
Well, there's no secret that a lot of Trump supporters, if not almost all of them, already have contempt for the press, and there's been this canard forever that there's a liberal media. In fact, some of the veterans groups that were, you know, there are sort of props behind Trump today, made those kind of remarks. What do you expect from the liberal media? So how much is he feeding the beast here? And how? And it's almost like you have two universes, the reporters who are getting insulted for just doing their job on the one hand, and then you got all these people out there who are rallying behind Trump who really do believe that the mainstream press lies and is against them and is elitist and all of those things that he tells them. And frankly, he's proven everybody wrong. He's proven the punditry wrong. So I don't know how we get a real reading on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's gone on for quite a few years where candidates have talked about the press being vicious and unfair, but it definitely has reached a new level with the Trump campaign. And it's been effective, as you say, not only in rallying people who are already suspicious of the press, but in insulating him from reporting that's unfavorable. Because he certainly, in addition to criticizing the press a lot, also courts the press a lot. I mean, he's been on cable news television far more than any of his opponents because it's a venue with which he's comfortable, and he knows he can get a lot of coverage, whereas Hillary Clinton, for example, is much more cautious in coming on television, and as a result, she's not getting the coverage that he is. So it's an interesting media equation for sure, because she, you know, certainly is probably just as contemptuous of the press as he is. She certainly feels like she's been unfairly attacked, but has not been able to use it to her advantage quite as much.
And there have been estimates, Noah Bierman, that Trump has gotten up to $2 billion worth of free media. I don't know how you really quantify that, but it's still pretty extraordinary how he has dominated the headlines. And there's been an attempt to sort of contextualize some of the stuff that he said. The Huffington Post, for example, at the end of all their stories, they have a little disclaimer saying, you know, he's a racist, misogynist, Muslim bashing, you know, crazy guy. So how do you cover this guy in the context of all that he said and done? At the same time, because he's the Republican nominee, you can see that people are rallying around him. The money's coming back. By definition, he's being dignified by the office that he is seeking. But at the same time, he has this extraordinary track record of saying outrageous and hurtful things.
It's interesting, yeah. I mean, I don't think the press needs to take it personally, that's for sure. You know, there were people who were sort of arguing with him at the press conference today that no, they were doing their jobs. You know, I'm not sure that's even necessary. I think they might be better off just asking him some more tough questions and getting on with it and letting him say what he wants to say. On that score, and just doing our best to be fair and to ask hard questions of the campaigns. But you know, as the bigger question that you mentioned, or one of the bigger questions, is just the amount of free media that he's been able to get. I mean, this press conference today was carried live on the major cable networks and it generates a lot of attention and interest. So they are eager to give him quite a bit of coverage. And while some of it is, you know, accountability-type journalism, a lot of it is just a platform that's allowing him to say whatever he wants to say.
And again, I'm speaking with Noah Bierman, who covers national politics for the Los Angeles Times from the Mid-Atlantic region out of Washington, D.C. Before joining the newspaper in 2015, he worked for the Boston Globe and before that the Miami Herald. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times slamming the media. Trump answers criticism over his contributions to veterans charities. Well, he's able to. Do you think, though, that this is a skillful tactic in any way to obfuscate and intimidate? He's sort of, you know, the Republican presidential primaries, where they started off with 17 on that big stage, he sort of knocked them all off the island one by one as though it were a reality show, and they simply didn't know, the rest of them didn't know the script, and he did. And anybody that crosses him, for example, Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico, was touted as a possible running mate. She's both a woman and a Hispanic, and he has problems with both of those demographics. And yet he goes out and insults her on a home turf. So it does seem that he's awfully thin-skinned. And I'm trying to get a sense of the difference between him being thin-skinned and not necessarily in control of his emotions. On the other hand, being tactical and basically bullying people into not wanting to ask him tough questions.
Yeah, I think that's a question that a lot of people have in different terms. But the question of being, you know, when he goes after Susana Martinez, is that an emotional response or has he thought it out? It looked like he actually did think it out. He brought a list of particulars with him, I believe, to that speech when he got up on stage. And he usually does not speak from a script, so he clearly had some points he wanted to bring out about her. And some of that may be to let people know he is not going to take criticism sitting down. And I think he's trying to make the case that he'll do that on behalf of the American people. And a lot of his supporters are eager to see that. They feel that too often in our diplomacy, we are, as he would put it, politically correct. And he wants to say, look, no, you know, I'm going to call it like I see it and be more confrontational, and if I break some china, that's okay. I'll get people to respect us. Different people will agree or disagree as to whether or not that will be effective as foreign policy, but it certainly has been, as you point out, popular among his supporters and helped him win the nomination.
So was this whole thing today some kind of an ambush then, given that, in this case, the press getting ambushed? Because it was previewed a lot by, you know, his campaign kept saying, we're going to make a major announcement about this question about the money for the vets from the event that he did back in Iowa early in the primaries when he boycotted the Fox Republican presidential debate. And then he gets up there, and the one line that he keeps, which again sounded like it was prepared, but if it wasn't, it was certainly an effective line, which is, you know, you guys are punishing me effectively for doing a good deed. And I'm sure amongst his followers and a lot of people out there watching television, you know, he's giving, what, $5.6 million to veterans organizations, and why are they beating up on him? So I'm just wondering whether, just apropos what you just said, that maybe this Susana Martinez thing was thought about beforehand, given that the campaign previewed this big press conference, and that's why everybody showed up. Did he pull off a kind of ambush?
Well, I don't think it was unexpected that he was going to critique the press and in some way make the press part of the issue here. The reporter you mentioned, David Fahrenthold, who has been the most aggressive Washington Post reporter in trying to hold him accountable for the money he said he was giving to veterans. He had him on a phone interview, I think, a week ago, where Trump said, okay, you know, I will give the $1 million that I pledged personally. But in the process, he called the reporter, and he printed in the story, a nasty guy for raising the issue. So we know that he feels these questions are out of bounds and are unfairly criticizing him for what he says is doing a good deed that he doesn't have to do. And I think that the theme there was probably set ahead of time. Now, you know, did we know it would take the exact form it did? No, and it was certainly a very unusual press conference in a lot of ways that you and I just discussed. But I think the general idea that he was going to make the media an issue shouldn't have been surprising to anyone who was watching it, either in the room or elsewhere.
So is it possible that his sort of thin-skinned testiness that he showed today was a result of the fact that Fahrenthold cost him $1 million?
You'll have to ask him.
Well, I'm going to be interviewing him tomorrow, so
yeah.
That will be a question.
Oh, David, no, I mean, yeah. you'll have to ask Donald Trump to know for sure, right?
Right.
Well, yeah, we don't know, but certainly, you know, if he wasn't planning on giving the million and that caused him to give $1 million, you could see why he would be a little annoyed, right?
Right.
But I have no idea. I have no idea if he was, you know, planning on giving $1 million. He says he was. It's a lot of these things only he knows, really. With the rest of us can try to ask him questions and hold him up to scrutiny. But, you know, as far as knowing what his intentions are, that's much harder to divine.
So just to focus then, Noah Bierman, on the question that was asked of Trump today at the Trump Tower press conference, ostensibly about the money that he had promised the veterans organizations. And he read a long list of how he was dispersing that money. But the question was, you know, is this what President Trump's press conference is going to be like? And he said yes. And he also went on to say that I'm not going to change, because there was some pressure from, I think, from some Republicans, and more than, I think, mostly Republicans, saying, you know, perhaps he should moderate his stance. And I believe that Susana Martinez, since she was the head of the Republican Governors Association, did leave a lot of Republicans scratching their head in terms of going after her. But just assuming that this is, you have to take him at his word, that he's going to be this way, is there an advantage to that in terms of basically, essentially, setting your own rules? Everybody so far that's been in that office has pretty much accepted the rules, the ground rules. And it seems like this guy's not going to accept the basic ground rules. And he certainly is not accepting the ground rules of civility. He called Hillary Clinton the other day a lowlife, which is an extraordinary thing to hear in a political debate.
Yeah, it's all been extraordinary for sure. And you know, at times we sort of lose our ability to be surprised, because it's been happening for months now. And early on, people would say, oh, this will be a defining mistake that will end his run for the presidency, and they've been wrong every time. And one of the things that you see in the exit polls, in the state-by-state exit polls, that as he started gathering victories, the question that he always scored really well with was, he means what he says. So if he does change, you know, some of those voters may say, oh, you know, he's selling out here. He's not the authentic guy that we thought we were getting. So there definitely is a potential risk-reward scenario there for him in, you know, changing the conventional rules of behavior for presidential candidates. Again, I still say we don't fully understand the calculus yet, because everything will be tested anew in the general election. And he may very well prove that, you know, the doubters at every step have been wrong, like they have been so far. But this is a different stage, and we don't really have the answers yet. We have some early polling that, you know, some of it state by state, some of it national, that are asking some of these questions. But I think we need to get a little bit deeper in to know for sure whether, you know, what's worked in the primary will work in the general.
But in getting deeper in, is there a way that you can sort of, I mean, what's apparent, I think, and it certainly was apparent at today's press conference at Trump Tower, is that Donald Trump will lash out at any real or perceived insult, and his strategy is to intimidate the opponent by, if you meekly criticize him, he hits you with a nuclear bomb, you know, and it's always asymmetrical. So a lot of people are making the observation that he's, I think it was actually Jon Stewart, the former host of The Daily Show, said the other day that he's like a man baby, you know, he just absolutely has tantrums. Now, if you go back to 1964 with Goldwater versus Johnson, there was, in the Johnson campaign, they floated the idea that Goldwater was mentally unstable and couldn't handle the nuclear button, or the nuclear button was something that should not be allowed in his hands. Subsequent to that, there was what's called the Goldwater rule, which is that no psychiatrist can opine on somebody's mental state unless they've actually treated them, because there were psychiatrists making comments about Trump. How do you investigate that idea of, you know, the very sort of thin cusp between personality and a personality defect?
Yeah, well, I think Democrats are exploring, okay, you know, how do we push that? There's the Clinton campaign seems a little uncertain still of what direction they want to go in attacking Trump. They're trying a variety of messages, some would argue, right now. You know, one of them is he's not who he says he is, which they were going hard on today, but using words like fraud and things like that. But others of them are, you know, he can't be trusted, which is a version of what you're talking about. And again, they can tie a variety of things to that message. Against that grain is the tremendous amount of media coverage that we talked about that he's getting. So, you know, the second you criticize him, as you point out, he can try to turn it to his advantage. So, and that's a dilemma they face, because he's has figured out how to maximize media attention and use negative attention to change the subject when he needs to, things like that. So, again, today, rather than talking about whether or not he fully and willingly fulfilled his pledge to give all the money to veterans, we're talking about him attacking reporters as a great beauty and another pundit as a loser, and, you know, going through the list of insults and having a different discussion. So, you know, that's been the rub. But, you know, eventually will there be a more of a reckoning, and will people be persuaded that he's not to be trusted because of some question of, you know, whether he's a solid enough figure? I mean, that seems to be where the campaign will ultimately be headed, right, from the Democratic opposition side. I agree with you that that's going to be a major issue that they're going to keep trying to attack him on.
Well, Noah Bierman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Noah Bierman, who covers national politics for the Los Angeles Times from the Mid-Atlantic region out of Washington, D.C. And before joining the newspaper in 2015, he worked for the Boston Globe, and before that, the Miami Herald. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times slamming the media. Trump answers criticism over his contributions to veterans' charities. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the other object of Trump's scorn at today's testy press conference, and that is the neoconservative kingmaker, Bill Kristol.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Oh, I do believe if you don't like things you leave for some place you've never gone before.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jacob Harbron, who is the editor of The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Harbron.
Thank you, Ian.
And today at the press conference at Trump Tower that was ostensibly called for Donald Trump to set the record straight on his promise to donate money from a fundraiser he did for the veterans instead of appearing on a Fox News Republican presidential debate. He nevertheless used that opportunity not just to slam the press and call them a bunch of sleazers, etc. I mean, it was an amazing display. But he also went after Bill Kristol, who he called, Bill Kristol is a loser. His magazine is failing. As you know, it's going to be down. I don't think it even survives. He's getting some free publicity. But Bill Kristol, I've been watching this for 2 years. There has to be, at any rate. So when I read the transcript of Trump says, you realize what an extraordinary diction he has. But in any case, clearly, Jacob Harbron, Trump is trying to preempt something that Bill Kristol is doing. But Kristol has promised in a tweet that he's going to come up with an independent candidate, an impressive one, with a strong team and a real chance. In other words, it's going to be huge. So when's this going to happen?
Only a crystal ball can tell you.
Well,
I think Bill Kristol is playing this beautifully. He's adopted a page from Trump. He's dominating the news cycle with a drip, drip of information. He's got everyone pondering and wondering, what's the next move?
Well, I guess so. Here we are talking about it. But you, at the end of the day, you've got to come up with a name. And the names that have been floated about don't seem to be coming forth. I mean, Senator Coburn was a name and Senator Sasser. And my understanding is that both of them have said they've said no, haven't they?
Yes, with Romney being the most vehement in the no camp since he's run several times already and flopped. It's impossible to know at this point if Crystal really does have a serious candidate or not. But isn't the interesting thing that he has completely unnerved Trump merely with the suggestion that he has a viable third-party candidate?
Well, Trump has gone on about it and saying, you know, it's not practical. You know, already the deadline is passed for Texas, although I believe that you could perhaps sue. But have the deadlines passed? I mean, you know, most of them haven't. But it's a lot of money. It's a lot of effort. So you're saying, Jacob Harbron, that this is Bill Kristol trying to outdo Donald Trump at his own game?
He is. But I wouldn't forget that there are a lot of multimillionaires and billionaires out there that are opposed to Trump and that could fund a third-party candidate in the hopes of derailing Trump. They figure they're going to lose the election anyway, but then they set up a candidate and for the next election cycle, and they help ensure that Hillary Clinton wins. For many people in the neoconservative set, Hillary Clinton is the lesser evil to Trump. They view themselves as being in the position of Winston Churchill in June 1941, welcoming Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union and allying with Stalin to stop the greater threat.
So there are, I think, a number of candidates, a number of wealthy donors that have held out. And, of course, the most conspicuous holdout so far is Speaker of the House Paul Ryan in not endorsing Trump. I don't know what kind of leverage he's trying to exercise, whether he's actually trying to get Trump to rein him in and to adopt the Ayn Rand platform instead of the stuff that...
Well, Trump delivered a pretty clear verdict today, didn't he? I'm not changing.
That was unequivocal. Yeah, and that relates...
I mean, in a certain sense, what occurred to me is that if Trump figures that his chances of winning the election are fairly slim, he needs a Hail Mary, then he has nothing to lose by continuing to behave as he does. To become a conventional candidate means that he loses 100%. But if he stays as he is, it's his only shot at winning by some fluke. Clinton gets indicted or something happens to her health-wise, some unpredictable black swan event. So from his standpoint, he's probably smart not to change.
Well, I don't think that his press conference today hurt him one bit, particularly with his own followers. I mean, you know, it's almost like he suckered the press into covering this because it was highly, you know, flagged as a big event and they all showed up. And he basically more or less said, you know, why are you guys beating up on me for doing such a good deed and giving $5.6 million to our veterans? I mean, that's going to play incredibly well with his constituency. And frankly, a lot of people in the country believe that there's a liberal media and they hate the media. And this is just...
Well, that's exactly right, Ian. I mean, the staple of the conservative playbook since the early 1950s has been to attack the cultural elite. I mean, that began with Joe McCarthy and William F. Buckley Jr., the universities, Hollywood, Manhattan, book publishers, they all form a conspiracy dedicated to suppressing conservative ideas. So Trump fits into that beautifully.
And again, I'm speaking with Jacob Harbron, who is the editor of The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. So do we know, though? I mean, this is the eternal question. People keep asking me all the time, do you think Trump's going to win? Do you think he could do it? Could it be possible? I mean, people ask you in highly emotional and distressed manners, could this be happening? Then you don't have an answer. I mean, do you have an answer? Do you know how deep the well of alienation and anger out there is that could propel this manifestly unfit person to the highest office in the land and the most powerful position on the planet?
It certainly could happen. I think it's unlikely. But the fact that he will be coronated in Cleveland, where I guess he plans to speak every evening, and it will be a true cult of personality, I assume. Once he has the nomination, he is the Republican candidate, and the party apparatus is lining up behind him. So I think it's unequivocal. The man could indeed become president of the United States in January.
So how do you break that bubble? I mean, everybody that's tried, he's knocked all of his rivals off the island, and he's the TV reality star, and he's so much better at playing that game. He's changed the narrative. He's actually made it more about. He's turned our politics into a kind of reality TV show. He's changed the entire narrative by saying the most outrageous things when nothing is off the agenda, and nothing is too low a blow. And he's got everybody on the defensive, and if you criticize him, he'll come back a thousandfold and slam you. So this is an extraordinary thing to watch. And so I guess back to Bill Kristol, do you know of any big names in the Republican establishment that are just willing to take this chance, which is obviously a pretty reckless one, to split the vote? It guarantees that Republicans lose, but would it be worth it in the minds of whoever these people might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think the calculation for someone like Ben Sasse would be, does he set himself up for the next election cycle? Would he in fact go down as a hero to the conservative movement for having defied Trump and stood for the true creed, which is an interventionist foreign policy and traditional Republican economics? Even if he only got 5 to 7% of the vote, he still would derail Trump. So the conservative intelligentsia is fighting for its own life. They desperately need a candidate to try and maintain the conservative gospel for at least another 4 years. Trump does have them on the run right now.
But it's been clear to me from day one that Trump didn't necessarily want to be president. He just wanted to win the presidency. And as Obama said at the correspondents' dinner, he ran, to improve the brand and to elevate the Trump brand. And it's almost like that scene in the movie The Candidate with Robert Redford. He suddenly won. And he can't believe it. And it's like, oh, what do I do now? So I don't think he would be averse, since he's an empty vessel, to having the establishment fill up the empty vessel.
Well, that's been the big question. I was wondering if the neocons would actually attempt to hijack his campaign. And there still could be a number of neocons who would clamber onto his bandwagon. But right now, it seems as though the party really is heading into the Civil War mode, if Kristol is able to latch on to someone who will serve as his spear carrier. It does show you, again, how inventive and tenacious the neoconservatives are, that they are the last people standing in Trump's way. It's not the traditional Republicans. It's the neocons who originally defected from the Democratic Party to the GOP.
Right, and not only are they the last people standing in Trump's way, they're prepared to tear the temple down too, right?
That is correct, because they believe the party should stand for an idea, and Trump is the antithesis of everything that the neocons stand for in terms of his non-interventionist foreign policy and his neutrality about Israel. So those are big no-nos for the neoconservatives.
But he's sort of almost reversed himself on everything he said in any case. So why do people take him so seriously? It seems like it's more about the fact that they don't control him that's got them worried, you know, that they've been able to look at the misadventures they sent George W. Bush on, you know. They controlled him.
Well, David Bromwich of Yale University said to me, Trump is the true unknown unknown. And I think that's what the neoconservatives fear the most, that he could lurch off in any direction, as you're saying, that he is not under their control. With George W. Bush, they were able to guide the prince. But what if Trump decides to behave like the king? Now, Paul Manafort said that Trump would simply be like the chairman of the board and outsource most of the duties of the presidency. But who knows? It gets, again, back to the fact that we don't have, pun intended, crystal clarity on what's going to happen in the coming months, because it's already been so unpredictable.
Right, but you can't beat a candidate without a candidate, and that's what it comes down to, right? Who is this mystery?
Correct.
Who is this mystery person that Bill Kristol is promising is going to be huge, who's going to be an impressive one, an independent candidate, an impressive one with a strong team and a real chance? I mean, the other name that's been floated is Mitt Romney, and that would go down like a lead balloon, wouldn't it?
True. Romney is the old, faded establishment figure who really arouses no enthusiasm among anyone, let alone the neocons. He was never that popular with them either. It just shows you really how desperate the situation has become for the Republican Party itself. The only thing they fear more than Trump getting the nomination is that he actually might win the presidency.
Well, that's, of course, a nightmare scenario for a lot of people. So, but I find it highly ironic that at the moment when, in spite of our conversation about what's going on behind the scenes with the Bill Kristols and the Republican kingmakers and the big donors and whoever it is, and by the way, Jacob, there's not too many Republican lawmakers who haven't endorsed him. There's only, what, five congressmen and two or three senators, right?
That's correct. I mean, the politicians are afraid of the base of the party, whereas neoconservatives don't really represent voters. There's an intellectual elite that has managed to steer influential politicians, say Tom Cotton, someone like that,
right,
or Ben Sasse, who is also close to the neocons.
Right, or Sarah Palin, who they discovered.
Right.
Subsequently, she went off the reservation. I was going to say that it seems, though, that by and large, in spite of this conversation, the Republicans are rallying around Trump, and even the donors are. So it seems ironic to me that at this moment, when the Republicans are coming together behind Trump and uniting, the Democrats, I think, are more fractured than ever, aren't they? Between Sanders and
it is. The irony is that you could have, I think it's unlikely, but you could have a contested convention in Philadelphia, so much for brotherly love among the Democrats. You could certainly have violence outside the convention. I mean, there seem to be a lot of Sanders followers who are prepared to engage in protests at the convention, and they feel quite aggrieved that they perceive the election as having been stolen from them by the Democratic National Committee. So it would be a surpassing folly on the Democrats to engage in that kind of behavior, but they've done it before. So if they want to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, they're certainly capable of doing that.
Well, that does seem as a possibility, but the other possibility is, of course, and this is not the Sanders people who get blamed for this so much as spontaneous demonstrators who were offended by Donald Trump, and they showed up in New Mexico, and they showed up in Anaheim, and they've shown up in a lot of places going back to Chicago. And my sense is that that's going to dog the Trump campaign throughout this entire election season. And those optics may not be good for the Democrats.
No, in fact, you know, Trump obviously, and I should have said snatch defeat from the jaws of victory before, but to Trump benefits from the brouhaha. He wants to have not simply campaign rallies, but events. And if he can point to a physical enemy and arouse his followers and show them that he's not simply concocting this, these threats, that they know that they have a real invisible enemy, that, I think, will immeasurably assist his campaign. He'll say that these people are un-American, they hate the police, they're part of what's destroying the greatness of this country, and so forth.
Right.
So that theme was obviously prominent in 1968, and it could resurface today.
Well, Jacob Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halpern, who is the editor of The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with Joe Garofoli, the San Francisco Chronicle senior political reporter who covered Bernie Sanders' rally in Oakland and his attendance at the Golden State Warriors victory game. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joe Garofoli, who is the San Francisco Chronicle senior political writer covering national and state politics. He has worked at the Chronicle since 2000 and in Bay Area journalism since 1992. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Garofoli.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Joe, you were the pool reporter to covering the Game 7 of the NBA Western Conference Finals between the Golden State Warriors and the Oklahoma City Thunder at the Oracle Arena in Oakland, California on Monday night. And at halftime, who should show up but Bernie Sanders with the actor Danny Glover. And frankly, I've not seen better campaign optics than some of the footage and the photographs from that event, where you've got the sea of yellow from the supporters of the Golden State Warriors, and then here's this white-haired man with a tan face and a blue Oxford shirt contrasting in the sea of yellow. So it seemed like it was an accident in a way, but it certainly also worked out in terms of design, did it not, for the Sanders campaign?
Yes, and it came together very quickly, like 24 hours before game time. Of course, the Warriors didn't know until 48 hours before game time that they were actually playing a game 7. So it came together very quickly. And so Sanders came from a rally I was covering in Oakland, and he made the trip that ordinarily takes about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, about 10 minutes, given the police escort and the motorcade. And he got there, and Danny Glover, first of all, he gets out of the car and he says, let's turn this thing around. The Warriors were down at the half, and after he arrived, they turned around and won the game.
Bernie Sanders is taking credit for that, right?
Oh, absolutely. As any good politician would, you know, he'd like to say someone different, but he right after the game, he said, you know, tongue-in-cheek, he said, absolutely. What else? What other explanation could there be for this? It was totally, and then, of course, it drew a parallel to his own campaign, where the Warriors, of course, in the series were down 3-1, facing elimination constantly for the last few games, and they came back and won a very improbable series turnaround
he is saying he said it was a good omen for his campaign. Now, one key difference is the Warriors are the defending NBA champions, and Sanders is not the the sort of the reigning incumbent. He sort of rails against the establishment.
Well, I think the context, though, is the whole Bay Area has gone nuts for the Warriors, haven't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Even when they stunk for many years, like two decades worth, they were just a terrible team, borderline unwatchable. And I'm saying that as a Warriors fan for all those years. I went to games for years, and you know, they had one or two good players, but they were just really bad. And the last few years, they've totally turned things around. It's been amazing. And now there's Warriors. Everyone's wearing Warriors gear all over the place, particularly in Oakland, which is the home of the Warriors. Now he says he got the tickets. The campaign did not buy them. Personally, Senator Sanders bought these tickets, and he didn't sit in the courtside seats. He sat about 25, 30 rows behind one of the baskets. These are not the seats of the millionaires and billionaires. They're definitely good seats. People around there pay about $285 a piece for them, face value. So, and one other thing, I wanted to loop back on this, Ian, what you said earlier was about how this is a great, publicity move and all that stuff. Yes and no. On social media, when I started tweeting out the first photos saying that he's here and the video and such, it boomed. But from what I understand, the network that broadcast the game didn't show him at all.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing.
But it's clear that his presence there was very welcome. People were wanting selfies, and people were chanting "Bernie, Bernie, Bernie." It's not like he was gate crashing.
No, he was. In a way, he was gate crashing because he showed up through the VIP entrance at halftime and was led up to his seat by the Secret Service. So there was that. Let's make it crazier, but. But people were generally very solicitous of him. People were handing him all sorts of stuff to sign. One guy gave him the shoes off his feet to sign. People were giving him T-shirts and hats and ticket stubs and anything to sign. One guy was giving him his fries, sharing his fries with him. He was doing that. And, he actually behaved like a fan, like a normal fan. He was cheering and such. Even though Danny Glover, who was there with him, he said, confided in me that he was is a Celtics fan, being from New England. And he stayed to the end, much unlike, shall we say, Laker fans.
Right. Well, but what a game and what an ending,
That was a fantastic game. There was some pushback from the people around him. Most of the folks said, it was great. From all the the selfies and stuff people wanted to take with them, but as we were coming in at halftime, as the players came back on the court, a couple of people said, "Sit down, come on, this isn't a political event, I want to see the game," because everybody else was paying $300-$400 for their seats too, so they wanted to, they were there to see a game. They didn't they like Bernie Sanders maybe, but they like the Warriors a hell of a lot more.
Sure. And again, I'm speaking with Joe Garofoli, who is the San Francisco Chronicle senior political writer covering national and state politics. He has worked at the Chronicle since 2000 and in the Bay Area journalism since 1992. But Sanders himself, gate crashing or not, is apparently a genuine basketball fan and a former player. I think he maybe still plays. He brags about his elementary school basketball team winning the Brooklyn Borough Championships. And, of course, there's that. I don't know if you've seen the YouTube video of the Fox News anchor, Megyn Kelly, absolutely amazed that Bernie keeps sinking shots after shot. He's making every single one, she says.
Yes, no, he does. He has done that on the trail. Apparently, whatever he's in the gym, he'll go out and shoot a few. It is a genuine like of basketball.
Right. So let's talk a bit about, I don't know whether you were at this event, but you said you were covering him prior to his arrival at the Oracle Arena in Oakland, California at halftime for that important and critical game, which decided that the Golden State Warriors are going to go on to the final. The event that took place in East Oakland on Monday night. Was that prior to the game or after, where the animal rights protesters jumped over the barricades and rushed?
Yeah, that was at the event just prior to when he went there, and it was over within seconds. That was at the event at just outside Oakland City Hall, where he was speaking right before he went to the Warrior game.
Uh-huh. So what happened then? Did you witness it?
Yeah, it was there. They folks jumped over. They were tackled in the audience by security, and then the Secret Service surrounded him. It was literally over with about 15, 20 seconds, and they it was unclear about what exactly they were protesting at first. He went on. He said something on the order of we don't intimidate easily, and went on with his stump speech. He spoke for probably, maybe 25, 30 minutes after that. So I think most Warrior fans were, in the audience, because it was in downtown Oakland, were hoping that he would cut short his stump speech, which he often speaks for, 35, 40, 45 minutes, sometimes an hour. But he did not.
So, but do the animal rights people, did they hold up a banner? Did they throw blood or whatever? I mean, how would you?
I didn't see any of that.
Right.
I didn't see any blood short, no.
So there wasn't any kind of manifestation of a political message then. They just rushed the stage in a second.
There was some, yeah. I was actually talking to other people in the audience for working on another story, and because we had a second reporter working on it directly. But when I looked up, it was over very quickly.
Mm. So let's talk a bit about what kind of impact this might have on this. The gap is closing pretty rapidly, is it not, between Hillary Clinton's lead is eroding. I don't know what the latest polls are, but there's no question that Bernie Sanders is making a really hard run to win California, and it's a winner-take-all, is it not?
He's campaigning. He's doing a number of appearances. In fact, I was just at one this morning, and he had two or three others scheduled after that. He was here in the East Bay of California, just across the bay from San Francisco. He had one in the town of Emeryville about health care. Then he was going to Monterey and Santa Cruz, and I believe there might have been even one other event after that. For the context, Ian, it's amazing. It's a year ago he was down 63 points in the polls. Last week, a Public Policy Institute of California poll, nonpartisan poll, which is one of the most respected in the state, has Clinton ahead, but they're essentially in a statistical dead heat. What's the challenge is in engaging the strength of the Sanders campaign is they don't know how many of the independent voters are going to come out for him. Because here, if you're an independent voter and you have to vote by mail, and you want to vote by mail, you have to request a Democratic ballot in advance. So the campaign is very concerned that people haven't gotten that message, and they could be leaving literally hundreds of thousands of votes on the table there, since, as I said, roughly half the electorate in California votes by mail. So there's a great concern there. So if those folks come out, he has a decent chance to win. And if they don't, one poll today by coming out of Stanford University's Hoover Institution had Clinton up 13 points. So, that one was a bit of an outlier. The polls that I've seen are a lot closer than that.
Well, I talked to the state senator in charge of elections and the head of the San Diego's Registrar of Voters to try and get some clarity on those independent ballots and the problems that the Sanders people were pointing out about them. And frankly, it was pretty hard to get clarity. I mean, I guess our elections are so ridiculously complicated, it's hard. But you think it's going to be a real problem then?
I think it may be. I mean, that's what the campaign has been telegraphing this for several weeks, their concerns, and saying it very openly in the last few weeks. And basically, if you are registered in California as a no party preference voter, not with the independent party, because that's an actual party, but if you have we used to call them decline to state a party preference or no party preference, you can vote in the Democratic primary. You can't vote in the Republican primary. That's only for registered Republican voters. So if you want to vote in the Democratic primary, if you, you know, vote the old-fashioned way and you go to your local polling place, you can request a Democratic ballot. But if you vote by mail, you have to request, make the extra step of doing that, requesting a Democratic ballot by mail. And the deadline to do that, I think, was yesterday or something. You know, there's a grave concern by the camp, by the Sanders people, that that those folks didn't know that, or they, you know, didn't read the fine print or whatever. I mean, we're all busy and, you know, and a lot of stuff to do. And we were like, oh, I didn't know how to do that. You know, you get a lot of that kind of stuff. So that's what their concern is.
Right, but they can. If you don't get it in the mail, you can still show up at the polling place, by the sound of it.
Yes, you still can. Yeah. Yes.
So just in the last couple of minutes, then, Joe Garofoli, let me get to the real question here. Since Bernie Sanders, tongue-in-cheek, said that he was responsible for the turnaround victory for the Warriors last night, do you think that his presence there, and as I say, the optics that I saw, notwithstanding that apparently the viewers didn't see it all, were, I think, the kind of things that politicians drool for, do you think it's going to help him in the state?
Oh, yeah. Well, it couldn't hurt him. It definitely helped him in the Bay Area. I don't think a lot of Lakers and Clippers fans are really going to be too pleased with him. Maybe it outweighs the those fans will be ticked off at him for showing up at a Warriors game. I don't know. It's, you know, it's all good. I asked him right afterwards. I was like, so what if they had lost? Then people would have blamed you. It would have been the Bernie jinx instead of the Bernie bump. And he said, hey, in politics, you just got to go for it. And that's kind of what his campaign's all about. He's going for it.
Right, but I think, though, isn't Steph Curry incredibly popular just across the board? I mean, not only him, but he's an adorable kid, you know.
He's the two-time MVP and the unanimous MVP, but I don't know how many people are linking Bernie Sanders to Steph Curry at this point.
Right, but at least he was there to witness that extraordinary moment. So if you're a betting man then, Joe, just in wrapping up here, who do you think is going to win the California Democratic primary?
I'll preface this by saying I'm world's worst prognosticator. The last two elections, I have said the following. I picked President Perry and President Walker. And we see how those picks are doing. So I don't know. I sense a strong Bernie momentum here, but I think the Clinton folks are going to hold on. And part of it may have to do with that confusion over ballots, but I think it's really too close to call right now.
Well, Joe Garofoli, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Joe Garofoli, who's the San Francisco Chronicle's senior political writer covering national and state politics. He has worked at the Chronicle since 2000 and in Bay Area journalism since 1992. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. We'll